Well, you know, that story of 1963, you know, it's particularly with the left sociologist, the sort of liberal University of Chicago sociologist, William Julius Wilson, and a lot of people writing in his ilk, there ended up almost being this curious kind of sentimentalization and this romanticization of the pre-neoliberal Fordist era, mass production era. Of course, in Black Chicago, you're already sort of out of that by 63. But, you know, there was this whole kind of narrative emerged about from what passed for the left and what passed for the right, and on the left, what really is wrong with the ghetto and why the ghetto is so desperately poor off is all the jobs disappeared. And then on the right, there was what's really wrong with the ghetto is, of course, well, what do they blame? They blame the welfare state, you know, which wasn't really even in force by 1963 in terms of things like AFDC expansion and various other forms of welfare state expenditure. And, you know, what that misses is how horrific things were when a higher percentage of the Black population in a place like the South Side of Chicago had jobs. It was absolutely horrific at its employment peak. It had a split level job market, and you talk about it. This guy had a degree at IIT. Yeah, they wouldn't even look at him, and that was typical at the time. Yeah, so I mean that history tends to get swept under the rug a little bit, and there was all kinds of misery, there was all kinds of poverty, and there was a related subculture of crime and drug running and all kinds of, you know, things that had to go on, black market supplemental economic things, they had to go into the ghetto back in the industrial era. So it isn't just about job loss, and it certainly isn't just about the welfare state, because they were miserable. The right wing blames how supposedly the welfare state made everybody poor. Well, they were poor before the welfare state came in. So those kinds of stories matter.
The last 2 years, it's been used to underwrite projects in the South Loop in places where it really isn't needed. So if you go into Englewood and different neighborhoods, corporations and the wealthy who benefit from it, his endowments, instead of putting it on the corporate
list. Right. Yeah, I remember when I was at the Urban League and the CEO there gave me some study. Chicago's a weird city in that it's broken down very specifically into 77 community areas, and then all this aggregate socioeconomic data is broken down. It's like goes back to the 1920s. And the community areas are very intimately, they're not the same as contemporary neighborhoods now, but they're pretty strongly related to them. And Compton, the CEO at that time, James Compton, said he wanted me to take a look at these numbers where all the economic development and the money in the city was going. And I mean, one of the great ironies of it was that the more economic development you already had, the more economic development money you were getting from both public and private sources. And there was this big, slick downtown connected. This was Daly, not Emmanuel. This is back in the day. They're working with 2000 census data. I wish I could remember the name of this think tank. They were like Boston Associates or something like that. And this was this incredibly glossy page, multicolored graphs, you know, and extraordinary sorts of presentations. They obviously had all kinds of resources, and they broke this down in every way, but they wouldn't break it down by race. So I just took the 77 community areas and plugged in the census data, which you can do in Chicago. It's so weird with these 77 community areas, and just plugged it in. It was the exact same thing as the communities that were getting the least. You know, economic development, you know, you think of industry, you think of, you know, the jobs and employment. But I mean, one thing I particularly remember from studying Chicago was the difficulty people had in certain parts of town of getting access to grocery stores and basic fresh vegetables and all that. We actually ended up doing a map about that and where all the Jewels and the Oscos and the Dominics were. So, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, but the TIF thing is just one of a million examples of something that's allegedly has progressive and meaningfully democratic aspects to it just being turned permanent doing the tool. And it's just a way of avoiding getting out of paying. I mean, it's not just Chicago, too. This is everywhere. I mean, Iowa City is, you know, always worried about TIFs and who gets TIFs and who don't get TIFs. And public schools get starved. Public sector gets starved that way. Yes, sir.
The demonstrations that I've been involved in the last few days, people are mainly talking about individuals. I mean, I agree. I would love to see Ron go, but right. Again, I'm not convinced it would make that much difference. So how do we introduce the vocabulary of looking at things at a structural level into these sort of movements?
Well, I might have some people here that can say a few things about that, too. But you know, I do think it's kind of a balancing act because it is sort of disheartening to hear people thinking that just because candidate eight, or I mean, if the Obama administration isn't an object lesson in how it's not just about changing a brand or changing a color, skin color, or personality. And then I don't know what it, you know, is ever going to be. But you can also end up sort of becoming an apologist for Emanuel staying in indefinitely. And in fact, I actually heard an alderman in Chicago named Will Burns, actually. Do you know Will? He's actually said, well, I don't think Emanuel has to go because really it's about structural issues. You just be careful. I mean, you want these guys to understand that they have to behave in a particular kind of way or their head's going to roll. And I think that there's actually a kind of institutional aspect to that. There needs to be accountability. I think history matters, and I think, you know, telling the different stories and being ready to talk about them. Well, we got this guy in, and it really didn't mean that much. You know, I think sometimes it can be useful to get certain people in, and then they become object lessons in precisely how it's really about institutional and political change. And that's why, at the end of the day, while next to maybe three or four other people, I was the most strident left critic of Barack Obama going back to like 2000. I mean, I started in on a keynote address in 2004, and then I was just getting warmed up by 2006. And yet, I would have told you I wanted Obama certainly to beat John McCain, because I really absolutely sensed that particularly millennials and young kids desperately needed an object lesson in the bipartisan nature of the corporatism of U.S. government and in the bipartisan nature of the American empire. And all the more better to get it with someone with all the sexiness and branding and imagery, kind of JFK-like, that was associated with Obama. I mean, that's something that happened in the early 1960s and in the mid-1960s, is this great lesson that after these two terms of this sort of gray, boring Eisenhower, and then in came this sexy, young, telegenic, fake progressive, ethno-culturally interesting, because he was the first Catholic president at that time, Kennedy. And it was this great object lesson that, you know what, everything still pretty much sucks. I mean, that's an incredibly negative way to put that. So I thought it was useful, you know, for Obama to get in there. And I think Obama has been useful for a lot of these young folks now. Asada's Daughters, Youth Project, what is it, Youth Project 100, and Black Lives Matter is a tricky kind of thing because there's different versions of Black, but whatever, all these, you know, they're over it. They got it. And all the young black folks I've been talking to the last few days when I've gone to a couple of rallies, they are talking about class differences within their community, and they're talking about generational differences within their community, and they are saying things like, well, Rahm's got to go, you know. I mean, I don't know what's wrong with this guy, too. There's just something, there's a genome factor here. They're just a missing deal with this guy. I mean, Rahm Emanuel was a bully when he was a little kid, and he just continues to be so. And I think the ruling class here in Chicago is kind of getting it, that this just is not a particularly functional CEO for corporate Chicago. And if he goes, that's why he'll go, because he's costing them money. So, you know, they don't like him and they want him gone, but they are, in fact, saying, I don't know that we have to tell them about that. I think that might be happening. I mean, they live it. They live They live an institutionalized police state system in their neighborhoods every day. They don't need you or me to tell them that it isn't just about Rahm Emanuel. And they have horrible interactions with black cops and Latino cops and female cops too. And that's very instructive to them. Because what they'll say is, it's institutional. You know, the blue code is institutional. So I think that's happening. I think if we listen, we can reinforce that. I don't. That's a partial answer to your question, anyway.
A company that made machine tools was government contractor. The company's policy was they would advertise in the black newspapers, Chicago Defenders, for machines, no experience necessary.
Really.
And they would hire a young black man, and they would bring him in to teach him to run a lathe.
Yeah.
And they would put him next to a lathe operator, a very good lathe operator.
Yeah.
He spoke no English. He was Lithuanian.
And he was supposed to be training the guy with the language barrier?
Yeah. So the young black man would stand there for 2 weeks and observe what the fellow was doing, and then they would give him his own job on another lathe machine and he'd screw it up.
Of course he would.
And then they get the next guy. And they went through this time after time.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing was, being a government contractor, they had to comply with the regulations, you know, hiring a certain number of guys. And that's what they used to show that they had.
Oh, they set them up to fail.
So,
yeah,
when
right.
I became aware of it, yeah. I worked with a fellow named Alice Holden, who was with the Chicago Urban League at that time.
Oh, okay.
And together we brought it to the attention of the Defense Department. And the Defense Department sent out an inspector. And he spent about 2 weeks looking over the records. And then he got his job, his cousin a job with the company.
Oh, really? That was it. That was his input.
That was it.
Jeez. Well, and you know, of course, so how long did you work? You ended up working as a machinist?
Same guy.
You ended up working as a machinist?
Yeah, I worked with.
Because a lot of those jobs ended up anyway getting wiped out by numerical control, right?
Yeah.
Ended up getting eliminated, yeah.
That
yeah, yeah. I can tell you a lot of personal stories about it's just amazing to me to this day how employers in manufacturing will just throw people out into continuous flow situations and expect them to know how to do jobs. I mean, but that's just disingenuous. You can't just watch a guy. I mean, you can't, that's a skilled job. You have to be able to communicate about that. You need to be able to ask questions. And I take it the Lithuanian guy was not particularly interested in training this dude? I'm just guessing that. I don't want to make statements necessarily against Lithuanians, but. Okay, right. That's a great, it's a terrible story. What I mean is a great story. It's a great, terrible story. Vinny.
Hey, man, I'm just going to break protocol here.
Yeah.
I've only met Paul today. We've been Facebook friends. We're also colleagues at Telesur English.
Yeah.
I have to run because of time, so I'm going to go up and give him a hug, and then you guys can
Okay.
Nice seeing you.
Hey, it was nice to meet you, too. This guy's a great writer on Telesur English and ZNet and anti-war activist, just super. So, Telesur English is a, you know Telesur? It's a out of Venezuela and out of Ecuador, and it's an independent left media, a little bit on the model of Al Jazeera, and, geez, what else am I thinking? RT, right. To try and invade the internet media space with something, yeah. They decided they try to have an English component. But we'll see how we do after the recent elections in Venezuela and how funded we're going to be. You know, I will say, just spinning off of that, it's amazing how many left writers will tell you that insofar as they can garner some money for their etchings, for their thoughts, it will often come from another country other than the United States. it's a sad statement on our democratic scene, so-called. Well, I was never quite comfortable with Occupy's reluctance to. I get the feeling from some of the black activists around here that it's kind of about getting Rahm out of the way because mayors have to be held accountable for egregious racist practices, but also get out of the way so that then we can stop talking about Rahm and actually get to the actual issues and those specific demands, which, you know, would include community control. They're talking about reparations. I never know what to make of reparations, whether people really, you know, what form it would take. But I think there's a lot of abstract historical justice for defunding the police, de-incarcerating. Now, I don't know if you've seen any of you, if you read Black Agenda Report recently, but there have been some problems with some self-styled Black Lives Matter activists who have just sort of made a point of powwowing with Hillary, you know, and or O'Malley to just kind of almost ask them to, you know, make sort of generic statements of I care about your issues. And so I'm asking them to articulate some policies that would help. No, that's not the way to speak, you know, that's not the way to speak to the elite. You tell them what, you know, exactly what you're for. You don't go get, in one case, Hillary ended up also like schooling them in how to be a rank and file activist. You gotta have a list. She's like giving them a Saul Alinsky lecture. You gotta have a list of four specific demands. That's not all of Black Lives Matter. That's a few people. One of the guys is named McKesson, and I'm extremely skeptical about him. He was a big Obama field organizer. I think he's got a video on Facebook of a White House dinner that was held for him. There's a certain component of people in every movement that are, and I saw this in Iowa City, I'm sad to say, at the latter stage of the Ferguson protests, who were really seem to be more than anything else about shutting it down and shaking down the local Democratic Party establishment for some money. So it's kind of a tricky kind of thing. You've got to have some contacts in that community and some dialogue in that community so that you're not just always, you know, applauding like a circus seal to everything that's going on in the black. You're not doing the black community any favors by not knowing anything about its own internal ideological and class and factional divisions. And so I feel lucky in that way, as I tend to have a lot of interaction, you know, with people who know a thing or two about that. And, you know, Black Agenda Report is a really important resource for people who are trying to get a handle on racism and its interaction with capitalism, imperialism in general. But also it kind of plugs you in to some extent on some of these divisions, and so you know who you want to organize with and work. Because I'm not interested in talking to people who are just trying to shake the foundation money tree and get a full-time paid job in the, you know, in the Hillary Clinton 2016 campaign or something like that. That interests me none whatsoever. Yeah, I don't know if I'm responding to you or not, Bob. I hope I am.
That is, I think, the concern for the Black Lives Matter movement, because from what I understand, again, and that's reading the general report, that they, I mean, he's of the opinion that they've pretty much been co-opted already. You know, they're going down that road where movements go to die, which is being reabsorbed into the Democratic Party. And
the great graveyard of social movements.
Right.
Yeah. Precisely. Yeah. I do think generally about demands and social movements, too, that one of our great deficits is that we are cherry-picked on too many single issues, and that has a lot to do with getting funding and foundations. And all of our different, many of our groups that we think are rank-and-file progressive groups are very narrowly focused on one particular thing, and then you turn out and you find out it's because some elite financial interest is or foundation is behind that. I'm a classic outsider on another issue. A classic example of that is 350.org. Which it turns out is getting all kinds of money. It just got all kinds of money just to focus in on Keystone. And it turned out that a lot of their foundational support is through the Tides Foundation, which it turns out happens to be a financial plaything of Warren Buffett, who happens to be the owner of BNSF Railroads, which happens to have a vested interest in Keystone going down so that those bomb trains, you know, the one that blew up in Quebec, can carry as much as fracked and tar sands oil as possible around the country. So we got to follow the money. We got to follow the money on the left too, all the time. Did you have something here? I would think that black activists would want to highlight those things in order to try and broaden the appeal of their issue and to say that this is, well, you know, and the things get sort of dangerously identity politicized, and then you get people saying, well, white lives matter too. You know, the Dash, so you're suggesting the dash cam videos end up, and the cell phone videos end up almost normalizing them. You know, I've been fascinated by the fact that we don't actually know if there's actually been an increase in the number of these incidents because there is no central database that's been tracking them. I think they're sort of guerrilla. You know, this Malcolm X grassroots project now scours all the records. I mean, it's just astonishing. We count everything in this country. We count all kinds of stuff. So I honestly do not know if there's just an increased awareness of these things and a capturing them of on video and a media attention to them. And that's the only reason we think there's more now, or if there actually is an increase. There are any number of reasons there might actually be an increase of them. You know, I almost kind of wonder if they become like dash cam snuff films sometimes for people, almost even for the enjoyment of people. I do worry about this kind of cycle of corruption and then sort of fake momentary reconciliation and then back to the same old thing. One thing I would watch out for in Chicago is a bunch of hoopla associated with a demand for an elected independent police review board authority. I mean, there's any number of judgeships around here that are regularly elected, and that doesn't make it particularly democratic or egalitarian. You know, you have the local school council elections, the school board elections, but those are actually relatively decent because you have some fairly organized parents groups and you have some fairly, and obviously you have the Chicago Teachers Union and you have a history. And if you started having elections for the independent review, so-called independent police review authority, what would those balance of forces be going into that elections? I don't see a lot of organizational entities that would be representing the citizens very well in them, and it's, I certainly wouldn't get all excited about that. I don't know, you say you'll take over the job of the AVIPRA and eliminate it.
Yeah, okay, right.
So this is in the context of community control. Well, you know, Gates is, I'm trying to remember the name of the group right now, and if someone knows it, you can fill in the blank spot in my brain, but he's a big enthusiast for nuclear.
Bullshit.
And right. And the problem is that they've buried the Fukushima disaster is just ongoing. I mean, it just continues. I know responsible people I otherwise thought were sane and rational and good people, including a physicist friend of mine down in Urbana-Champaign, who just insist that we've got to do that, and the risks—it's just we have no idea what to do with it. I mean, just one of these things going bad. I mean, just look at how devastated the areas around Chechnya is still, and
there's
I've got a piece in Scientific American from 2009, and I'm not going to remember the exact names of the professors right now. One is at Stanford and one is Caltech, and they ran the numbers and they looked at the viability of the technologies right now, and they said it's fully technically feasible now to convert with the existing global population to wind, water, and solar. And the cheapest are getting technologies are getting cheaper every day. And their conclusion, both these guys are hard science. Well, one's an engineer and the other's a hard scientist. And their conclusion at the end, The conclusion at the end is it's all about a political barrier almost completely, and it's the how we're held hostage.
Of
Scientific American,
It's on my website somewhere. I linked it, and I suspect that they're right. But I think of something as big as a full conversion of a global energy system from fossil fuels and nuclear to fully renewable is a task that's probably bigger than what is possible under the kind of competitive, market-based social chaos and competition that is capitalism. I don't know how... We have this topic, but everything's interconnected now, as Dr. King used to talk about. All the evils that are interrelated. You know, I would say now his three were militarism, racism, and economic inequality. I'd say if he was alive today, he would expand that to the quintuplet of evils that are interrelated and include patriarchy and ecocide, and show how they're all interwoven with one another. So, the prison issue and the climate issue, they're all in the at the end of the day all tied up with one another, but that's why I'm an eco-socialist. I really am absolutely convinced that the necessity for public ownership and public control is sort of a matter of life and death for survival. I don't think we're going to get the ecological transformations that are required now for human survival, literally human survival, under the profit system. And there's a lot of interesting talk right now too about how capitalism itself as a system literally is now at its final frontiers in terms of its capacity to appropriate cheap nature, food, raw materials, and energy. And for me, this is why Bernie Sanders' reluctance to talk about socialism in a deep sense would be less of a problem right now. And I'd be more tolerant of it and more excited about just saying, well, we got to have a Sweeney's, you know, welfare state and have less, you know, less military and less prisons. And, well, of course, he doesn't say that, does he? But in any event, I'd be more excited about that and less critical of his failure to talk about socialism in the real deep sense of public control and ownership of the means of production. If I'd be more willing to put that aside a little bit if capitalism wasn't driving humanity over the cliff of survivability. This gentleman, I know he wanted to say something before I saw you say anything. Yeah. Well, I mean, Germany responded to Fukushima by shutting down nuclear completely. My physicist friend is a Francophile and spends his summers in France, and I think they give a significant percentage of. The nuclear power is really big there, and so I think he thinks that because France does it, then we can do it. Everything French is good.
And you should do it.